国内。
This is Listening to Pictures, Artists on the SFU Art Collection, a radio program from SFU Galleries featuring voices of artists with lived experience on the West Coast who reflect on their favorite artists and works in the SFU Art Collection. And we're your hosts. I'm SFU Galleries Director Kimberly Phillips.
And I'm Publications and Special Projects Coordinator Karina Irvin. The SFU Art Collection consists of over 5,800 works and was established soon after the university's founding in 1965. The collection is unique in its capacity to trace the complex social and cultural life connected to this region and remains open to new inquiries and stories as they surface.
For Listening to Pictures, we invited artists to select a work from the collection and consider why it is meaningful to them, to reflect upon the memories or associations it calls up, the relationships it maps, and the political and cultural context from which it emerged. An accompanying suite of limited edition cards, each picturing one of the selected artworks, which you can order from SFU Gallery's website, is offered as a visual reference while listening.
All recordings were developed by the artists themselves, resulting in unique approaches to the artworks they chose, from lecture-style meditations and poetic tributes to political commentary and collaborative sonic experiments. Each invited artist's response, then, is a creative extension of their own practice.
This program was inspired by a 1964 CBC radio program of the same name, hosted by the renowned art historian Dr. Jean Sutherland Boggs. To find out more about the program, download episode transcripts, image descriptions, or other resources, or to subscribe to receive a set of printed cards, visit our website at sfugalleries.sfu.ca.
In this fifth episode of Listening to Pictures, we hear from Ken Lum on Corita Kent, who chronicles the influence and impact of her work and considers her position as an important voice in the field of pop art.
Ken Lum is a Canadian artist based in Philadelphia, USA, where he is chair of the Department of Fine Arts at the University of Pennsylvania. He has a long exhibition record, as well as an extensive record of essay publications and curatorial activities.
Hi, my name is Ken Lum, and the artist I've selected from the SFU art collection is Corita Kent, or also known as Sister Corita. There's a number of reasons why I chose Corita Kent. I'm more interested in this moment where, even as a kid, I was one of the few artists I had some introduction to. This is well before I knew anything about the art world. I remember she was featured in certain magazines and even making some magazine covers, I believe, and at the time, so she had a degree of renown with the let's just say popular audience, as opposed to the art audience, which I didn't know much about at the time, since I was only a child. But I was also interested in her, what it says about the art world, how her position relative to the art world, which is something that's always kind of interested me as an artist. I've written many essays on it. The other thing that interests me about Corita Kent is this period of the early to mid 1960s, and what it calls up for me. You know, during that period, of course, in contemporary art or modern art, it was pop art, almost exclusively performed by male artists, such as Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Mal Ramos, Robert Indiana, Tom Wesselman, Klaus Oldenburg, you name it. Very few female or women artists at the time. And so popular culture was seen as very gendered, I would say. And they were very interested, of course, in the surfaces of things, the liners of soup cans to all kinds of advertising graphics and so on, and they ironize the kind of low mass cultural surface visual field by elevating the semiotics of mass culture to high art, primarily through painting, right? So Lichtenstein silkscreen is not strictly a silkscreen in the sense of it being on print paper and so on, but it has the scale and the presence of historical painting. It's done with oil paintings. It's done on very large scale stretch canvas and so on. And so there was this persistent element of looking at American popular culture, the consumer society, the world of commodities with a critical eye. Even if that eye is not overtly critical, there's a kind of abstaining of opinion about that surface. There's an implied criticality precisely because that type of agnosticism was never really supposed to be an operation of high art. High art was always about registering history, registering the sentiments, the opinions, the expressions through gesture, through technique, through composition of the artist. And so it was never to be something that was just passive and so on. So that was the irony and force of pop art. In fact, the ambivalence of pop art, you might say, was that its passivity with respect to the question of being explicitly critical of the, you know, expanding and dominating and entrenching field of popular images, popular content, popularization through commodities, commodification processes, that was carried with it its own kind of criticality. Even the idea that it was no longer possible to be critical was a critical idea. And so Critic Kent doesn't really fit into that sense of what the art world would expect of art to perform in that day, since she was a woman and the bias was strongly towards men. The kind of silence, even the silence of pop art, was the silence of the male artist, the person who doesn't speak, the kind of, you know, the sheriff, like Gary Cooper in High Noon, doesn't say very much. And B, she didn't really make high paintings, so there was no device of ironization to the extent that like a Warhol painting performed. So her work was almost exclusively, and I hope I'm correct here, screen printing. And screen printing was always seen as marginal to high to painting in terms of ambition, fairly or unfairly. It was always seen as, well, you know, it's highly reproducible. It's very, it's a kind of, you know, modest technique. The scale is more modest and so on. And it doesn't have the historical resonance of painting, the direct application of the hand and the brush onto the surface of the canvas. And so she was fairly or unfairly somewhat marginalized for that. I think the other reason why she was somewhat marginalized historically is that, you know, there was a belief, maybe it's still going on, but it was certainly a romantic belief that, you know, if you are called to be an artist, you be an artist first. You don't be something else first. You may have a secondary job to maintain your practice and ambitions of as an artist. You could be a barista at Starbucks, for example, but that's not your calling, right? Your calling is to be an artist first and foremost, and to subsume all other activities to the calling of being an artist. And Critic Kent was a religious figure first and foremost, and so that, you know, many of her works always had a kind of let's just say religious, be happy, kind of moral message to them, even if it wasn't explicitly or specifically a citation of scripture or anything like that. The message was about faith, celebrating life, optimism and so on. And so that would be in keeping with her religious being. And so she was hard to fit into that moment precisely because, you know, she's a nun first and an artist second. So there's a sense that not that she's a dilettante, but that she is a novelty. She is a kind of anomalous figure within the field of pop art. But I think also, ironically, that you can make the argument that it was precisely because she was not an artist first, but she was very deeply interested in art, that she was even more pop than the pop artist, right? Because she really embodied the principles of pop art, that, because true surfaces, true advertising surfaces, true labels on tin cans of soup, all of these true billboard surfaces, they don't really have a criticality. They were never meant for that. They were meant to sell a message or to sell an object or something. And so in a sense, what she did was, you know, something that eludes in a way the art system, the demands of the art system. Of course, it never eludes it completely, but it skirts it. And it stays within the confines, by and large, of popular culture. And she herself became a popular culture figure. And so in that sense, I think it's ironic that she was marginalized for those reasons I outlined, as someone external to the art system, but was still, you know, it flattered the art system because the art system likes someone to, like, such as critic Kent, is a nun, to flatter them. And yet at the same time, they weren't accepting of her. And yet she was in many ways the embodiment of pop. She was on, as I mentioned earlier, on magazine covers. She had her own fame and so on. The other thing I was really interested in critic Kent is just during the time period. I'm not speaking about her, maybe inclusive of the late 50s when she was making these kinds of George Rawl type, you know, I would say Europeanized abstract expressionist paintings. And they weren't paintings, they were screen prints as well, but they were more very layered, very complex and so on. But then in the 1960s, from the late 50s all the way up to the mid-1960s, you had in popular culture this kind of fascination with nuns. I'm speaking about the spate of movies during that period, which I've seen all of them at the time, even, I'm afraid to admit, such as The Singing Nun by starring Debbie Reynolds, which was based on the biography of a true singing nun from, I can't remember if she was from France or Belgium, or maybe even Switzerland. And, you know, they sang a very famous song called Dominique. And also Lilies of the Field, which was a movie starring Sidney Poitier, the only really well-known African-American actor at the time. And of course, he helps these helpless nuns, European nuns, I call that, salvage something in their fields, and he's very handy, and so it was a kind of curious movie about racial justice and equity issues and so on, but through the prism of through the device of these nuns. There was also The Flying Nun with Sally Field, which was a popular TV show. I forget what you call those kind of gull-winged hats that the nuns would wear. Some nuns would wear. And anyways, with Sally Field, it was the idea that if she discovered that with a gust of wind, she could actually fly by controlling the gull wings on her hat. I don't know if it's a habit or a hat, what you call it. And also The Trouble with Angels with Hayley Mills, which was a Disney film. I saw that as a little boy. I was probably only about, I'm not sure, 6 years old. And of course, The Sound of Music. How could I forget? The Sound of Music with Julie Andrews. And what all of these films, and they all were issued about the same time in the early to mid 1960s is that it was a time of innocence. Nuns were sentimentalized. They were kindly. They were saintly, in fact. And they were the vehicle for racial justice in the case of Lilies of the Field. And so there was this image of the nun, and of course later in the 1960s, the end part, you had liberation theology in Latin America, nuns, priests, and so on. And this was, of course, before the start of the 1970s, when you had, let's just say, a kind of counter cinema to this very kind of celebratory, sentimentalized, definition, depiction of saintly nuns. With, I'm thinking of movies like Ken Russell's The Devils, and then the nuns were even became parts themes within horror movies like The Omen and so on. I should also add that in the early 1960s, you had the very famous immolation, self-immolation of a Buddhist monk in the streets of, I believe, Saigon in 1963 or 64, and so on. So this person, who burnt himself in protest of the ongoing war that was taking place, civil war that was taking place. And so you have this image of, a kind of religious figure that was kind of elevated and unchallenged in terms of their purity, their innocence, and so on. And so for me, since I'm old enough to have gone through that period as a boy, there was a kind of nostalgia for me of that, all right? And almost like a moment of the moment before I realized how nuns were as fallible as anyone else. Religious figures are as fallible as anyone else, perhaps even much more fallible, taking into account, First Nations residential schools and so on. And so I was kind of interested in this period of innocence before the fall from out of grace. Now, one of the things I was also interested in is, I mentioned the male artists. The male artists were able to deal with all kinds of content, right, which saw favor within the art system. There was, in the Warhol paintings, there was car crash, suicide, race riot, electric chair, a lot of imagery of people getting shot, killed, as part of the disaster series, which was highly critical, right, in the kind of Warholian sense of what was going on in the streets of America at that time. You also had other male artists like Tom Wesselman, Rosenquist, Mal Ramos, or Richard Hamilton, who, incorporated female nudity into their work. And something which, of course, would not have been possible for a religious figure such as Critic Kent would make paintings of, almost like Stuart Brisley, like screen prints of poems from E.E. Cummings, the kind of great experimental modernist poet. And the other thing that she did was she also did take a lot of advertising commissions. Most of the artists in the art world, I don't believe, did do that, but she did. And later on in the 1970s, I know she, because I've seen it, she painted a large strokes, the kind of rainbow strokes of color onto a gas tanker, which I believe is still there. It was there 5 or 6 years ago when I was in Boston. And it's a very effective piece, and she signed some Kurita. So, certain things wasn't open to her in terms of the subject matter, and those things, such as precisely for the reasons perhaps that she's a religious figure, so she couldn't have incorporate female nudity and so on. But it was also a sign of the gendering, the sexism that was inherent within the art system dominated by men, and they were allowed to, of course, as men, play with softcore pornography, play with the, you know, extend the female's muse, and so on, and such. It actually reminds me of, you know, this book by Eunice Lipton on Edgar Degas, which was a kind of corrective to a long-held belief that, you know, Degas was much more ambitious artist than someone like Mary Cassatt, precisely because he was able to go, he painted street scenes, he painted behind the curtain, the dressing room of ballet dancers, and so on, never taking into account these opinion makers, never taking into account that Degas, as a male, could walk anywhere in Paris unescorted. You know, a woman of middle class bearing, such as Mary Cassatt, would not have that privilege. And she would not have privilege of all kinds of private spaces either that Degas had as well. And so that was something else that I was also interested in. I guess the other thing I was also interested in terms of Kurita Kent is how her work plays up text. And I think her best work deals with text, right? With color and text. And text, you know, by the 1970s, was seen as, you know, a device of criticality, because in the aftermath of what became known as the crisis of representation, that is this challenging of the sanctity of images and of photograph even, and so on, text was seen as something that could stand in for and compensate for, you know, the kind of dishonesty, you might say, the deceit, the deceptive potential of photography, in particular, of the image, and so on. That text had a kind of authority precisely because it didn't have, it was believed, it didn't have as strong an aesthetic dimension. And so you had works later on, of course, the next decade by Martha Rosler, you know, the Bowery and Two Inadequate Descriptive Systems. And the idea is that both systems are inadequate, but there was a popular belief at the time that, you know, from art and language to Condé and Beveridge to Conrad Atkinson to the Fox Group, that text was precisely because it didn't carry the baggage of representation, you know, such as painting or even sculpture carried historically, that text was somehow anti-art in the sense that it doesn't bestow pleasure, it doesn't satiate the expectations of the art viewer as readily. And I think that part of her work is what I find the most interesting, this kind of insistence of text, even if the texts generally are somewhat mild, somewhat celebratory, and so on. It also was somewhat prescient of, you know, New Age language. She was very Unitarian Church kind of idea, your United Church, not Unitarian, but United Church kind of idea transcendence of the self via acknowledgement of a greater being, not necessarily. And she was unusual in the sense that I don't believe there is many works, if any, where she actually explicitly spells out God's in God's incarnations according to the Catholic Church. So it stays in this kind of poetic realm, and of course that makes it more acceptable as art as well. And so those are mainly the thoughts I have in terms of Kurita Kent. Was she a great artist? I don't know. I'm more interested. I'm never interested in that question so much. For I think there's a lot of really interesting figures that are slightly outlier to the system of art, which offers all kinds of lessons for the art world, but the art world's too inward turning to know this or even take those lessons to heart. And I think they should. And I think she's a kind of a great example for anyone to learn about the operations of the art world as well. And so those are my thoughts on Carita Kent. Thanks a lot.
This podcast was organized by Kimberly Phillips and Karina Irvin at SFU Galleries with audio production by Jean Paizeau. The accompanying image cards were designed by Information Office. Listening to Pictures has been made possible with generous support from the Canada Council for the Arts Digital Now program and is produced in partnership with CJSF FM. SFU Galleries is supported by Simon Fraser University, the Canada Council for the Arts, and the BC Arts Council, along with numerous foundations, community partners, donors, and volunteers. We are especially grateful for the visionary support of the Marianne and Edward Gibson Trust.